Hello, everybody, and welcome to 3-Point Perspective, the podcast about illustration, how to do it, how to make a living at it, and how to make an impact in the world with your art. I'm Jake Parker.
I'm Lee White.
And I'm Will Terry. And all three of us are professional illustrators. And we've all worked for about the last 25 years illustrating for every major publisher in the business. We've published together somewhere around 100 books. And we've all taught illustration at universities.
Each week we tackle a new subject in illustration. Sometimes we're going to fight. Sometimes we're going to hug. But each time you are going to learn something new.
should we mention the fight that we're planning when you guys come out here?
The battle?
Yeah, the battle.
Battle Royale?
Jake runs, which is dumb. He runs like 6 miles a day or something. And then Lee, he plays frolf or something like that.
Oh my God.
Frisbee golf. And I play racquetball. So the idea is you get 3 points for winning one of those.
And we're going to have a race. We're going to have a frothing contest.
Stop the froth. You can't say froth. That's not fair because you guys don't have like lame descriptions of your sport.
You get 2 points for coming in second and 1 point for losing. So who can get the most points? I know I'm going to lose the run. You guys are like,
I'm going to crush you guys because I'm great at disc golf, and then I'm pretty good at the other two. That's why I'm going to win.
You suck at racquetball, let's face it.
No.
I've never held a racket.
I need Jake to win. I need Jake to win racquetball because I can come in second in golf, in frolf.
I don't know. You guys would be a good battle. I don't know who's going to win with that, but I'm going to win overall because I'm going to win the disc golf. I'm going to get second in the running and second in the racquetball.
I think the three should be pool, darts, and that game where you slide something across.
We saw you do the shuffleboard when we were at CTN or whatever
you've been a shuffleboarder.
He's got some weird...
Yeah, some weird karma with the shuffleboard or something.
It's not weird. It's skill. It's straight up skill.
Yeah, well, we don't want any of that.
Okay, so today's topic is Lee's. We're going to let him take it away. What are we talking about today, Lee?
All right. Today we are going to get into, if you can believe it, we're going to talk about how we actually make illustrations. It's a podcast about illustrations. We're going to talk about how we actually make the illustrations. People love process. I love process. I love hearing other people's process. And so I thought I would, I don't know how well this is going to work. It's going to be, people aren't actually looking. We have to describe it so we get to use our writing skills. But I mean, there's little things that we've learned along the way. And so I'm going to go through 8 steps that kind of happen when I'm doing new work. And I'd like you guys to follow along, but then also think about how you used to do some of this stuff versus how you do it now. Mm-hmm. And we will compare and contrast and we'll fight too.
Sounds good. All right.
So the starting point, this is where, this is the blank piece of paper. Typically for me, I'm starting with a client brief. If it's going to be professional work, I'm going to kind of break it down into different kinds of work. But if it's professional work, I'll have a client brief. And if it's my own, I will definitely write my own brief. But the big thing that I do, the common denominator between those two things is no matter what the client has said and no matter what I want to do, I always break it down. And this has taken me a long time to learn this little sentence or this little question, but what is my intent? Mm-hmm. It's such a simple thing to ask yourself in the beginning, and it can drive so many different solutions, or I guess it sets the stage for coming up with a real solution to a narrative problem, which typically illustration is a narrative problem. And it keeps you on track. I don't know. Have you guys ever had a problem with that where, say you're in school, for example, you're learning all these different techniques and you can add perspective and anatomy and all this stuff. And somehow the actual intent of a piece gets lost with all the technique and all the other stuff.
Yes, that was and is one of the biggest problems I think illustrators face is getting lost in beautification. And forgetting the main purpose of what you're doing, why you're there. You're there to communicate first and make a beautiful picture second. Mm-hmm. And that's why I think so many styles work that are really primitive better than really highly sophisticated rendered styles is because sometimes they just communicate super quick.
Right.
The artist forgets what they showed up to do that day. The reason they're there for that image.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's realism can get really lost in all that stuff. I do think what you just said, Will, is totally true. It's, if you're doing realism, it's very hard to stay to the intent because there's so much stuff you got to know to make a realistic image. Mm-hmm. It's hard. Jake, how do you go? How do you start?
I usually, I guess intent, it depends on what I'm working on. So if it's, if I'm plotting out sketching out, thumbnailing out a page for a children's book or a comic book, intent or getting across the message is number one, just like you said. If it's some sort of concept art or character design, something like that, it's less about the intent, really, that question sort of taken away because I'm just drawing the object that needs to be designed. And usually, and with both of these, is I'll just start with really loose, scribbly pencil renderings that only I can interpret, really. If you were to show someone the first pass of what I do.
Oh, wait. You can't talk about that stage yet. That's my stage three.
Stage three? What are you doing between...
Well, step one is like, before you even get down, I mean, and like, what are you drawing? Like, how much interaction do you have with the client before you actually start drawing? How much do you know of what you're going to actually do before you start thumbnailing?
Can we talk about what kind of a job we're doing?
Yeah.
Because it varies.
All right. Let's pick two. Like for me, it'll be like a client versus my own personal kind of an image. Those are the two images that I make.
Okay. So like a children's book and a personal piece that you're going to sell in a gallery.
Mm-hmm. Both of those pieces for me start with writing. They don't start with drawing anything. I make big lists of keywords. Again, going back, what's my intent? So the first step for me, all these keywords start to come out and things I want, how I want the image to feel. I make notes of like who I'm going to research. I don't know. It becomes a written process versus drawing.
Jake, I let you go first so that you could be wrong. I knew I'd be wrong if I went first because Lee had this all mapped out.
I have never written down anything before.
Really?
Before starting an illustration? No, that's crazy to me.
Dude, should try it.
Really dumb, Lee.
You should try it because it changes the way that you thumbnail.
I'm not saying it's a bad idea, but I'm actually quite intrigued by it. I'm curious how that'll change my workflow, you know, and just my initial like idea stage. That's cool. But I usually just, I kind of have an idea in my head, what I want it to be, what I'm thinking it's going to be. And then I just dive right in.
Yeah.
And I
think you're so intuitive at this point, but I mean, if you're not totally intuitive about the whole process, I would recommend you guys write it down. For example, if you're going to do a background and, or a more environmental scene, it needs to be scary. Man, writing down like this needs to be mysterious, scary, and foreboding. You know, you got those three words down first. It will absolutely change if all your loose thumbnails have to be compare and contrasted to those three keywords. It will guide you along the way. You'll know instantly whether you hit it or not.
I have a tangent that is related to this, and that is
tangent out.
Tangent out. This is a question, and I've seen this floating around the internet every once in a while, but do you actually, can you see images in your head, or is it just abstract? You have to actually draw it on the paper before you could start seeing what it is.
Mine always is like kind of like a dream, like, you know, when you're trying to describe your dream, but you don't totally know what happened. It's a little bit fuzzy. That's how mine are. I know what's happening sort of in the gist of it, but I can't see very clearly. So I'd have to start sketching it out.
Like you wouldn't be able to close your eyes. You couldn't see like a perspective drawing and then copy it onto the paper.
No, some of them come like that. It just depends on what the concept is, I guess. Mm-hmm. If it's like a single item, like I'm going to do this really cool tank, you know, typically I can see that perfectly clear, you know, if it's a concept kind of thing. But if it's again, the more storytelling I need to do, the more I need to kind of pull it out of the haze.
Right. So like when someone says the word apple, you know, some people say, I see the word apple. Some people say, I see like a hazy, foggy image of an apple. Some people just have the abstract concept of an apple. And some people have like a photograph image of an apple with like beaded moisture dripping down the side of it. Which one of those would you say is you?
I mean, I can definitely, again, simple item stuff, total photo real.
What about you, Will?
I see the photo.
You see the photo? Yeah.
Sometimes I just see in ones and zeros.
There's a Matrix GIF coming your way.
So I just bring that up because that might be, because I've read about some artists who can't see it and they're actually sitting sketching on a piece of paper. Maybe the word thing really helps there, but they're sketching on a piece of paper trying to find that image because there is no image in their head. And I don't know, I wanted to see if that's how either of you worked or not.
No, the apple, just to compare and contrast that and a concrete example, that one of the spots that I'm drawing today for my chapter book is this letter arrives and the main character, it had been sent over a year ago, and it's this letter that got lost in the mail. It's a really important piece of information to the story, and it arrives, and the different people that are in the room have a different reaction to this letter. And that one is one I do not get the clear picture. It's a hazy picture of how the scene is unfolding, but it's not an obvious composition like some other, like an establishing shot of an environment would be. So that one's one that I really got to search for a little bit more.
Okay. Interesting. All right. And then
continually,
Well, all right, so you get your intent. You write a couple of. Oh, go ahead, Will. Do you got anything else to add?
No.
Okay.
You guys covered it pretty good. Yeah.
All right. Good.
All right. So you've got your couple of keywords maybe written down. You know what you want to do. The next step for me is gathering. I start a little bit of research and development before I start just drawing. But sometimes I go back and forth between. So the next two on my list are research and development and very, very loose, scribbledy junk thumbnails. And depending on the project, I kind of go back and forth on what happens next. Sometimes I start the thumbnails and they're really crappy drawings first and then use that as a guide to what research I'm going to need. Other times I will go straight to the research, look at a bunch of images and things just to get a feel for it and then go to the rough, very loose thumbnail stage. What do you guys do there?
You want me to go first?
Yeah, go for it.
I don't do as much work as you do, Lee. I think you're working too hard.
Well, all this happens fast. I mean, I do this while I'm eating lunch.
Oh, I'm teasing. No, it's different every time. If I'm working on a children's book, I usually like to nail the characters first. And I've always been an advocate of writing descriptions of your characters. As you know, you have to visualize it first. So you read the story. You know, you read about the characters, you read about, you know, what motivates them, you know, what their special abilities are, what, you know, and then for me, I come up with different looks because I don't want to, as I design out my illustrations, I want to have a general idea that I know what my characters are going to look like first, even though I'm going to make blob, you know, little shapes for their placeholder, so to speak, in the design, because I'm not drawing, I'm just designing thumbnails and really, really small. I still want to know, I don't know, I just always want to, it's like I feel more comfortable when my client has approved the character direction, character designs. So I like to get that nailed first. And so I'll do a lot of sketches.
So you do those character sketches for, and then you actually submit the characters for approval?
Yes.
Interesting.
Yeah. And it's just, I just feel like, because if I go in a direction and I, you know, and there's not a lot of description about a character and I say, okay, well this, in my mind, this is what it's going to look like. And I go through all the little drawings and thumbnails and comps and stuff to submit. And then I've got it totally wrong on what they were thinking. I don't like to have to go back into every illustration. And
do you do that for images that are for yourself too? Like say for your personal projects, do you do the character first and then put it in the scenario it's supposed to be in?
Sometimes. Yeah. Sometimes I'll do little, but in general, the one thing, I hope I'm not getting ahead of you.
No, go ahead.
But the main thing that I want to nail before I really ever start drawing and designing is the concept.
So again, it goes back to what is your intent?
What is your intent? Right. So for instance, I've got, I just pulled up my Bonaparte book, the first one. And there's a part in there where he trains his dog. It doesn't say how he trains his dog. It doesn't say what activity he trained his dog on, which I love because I get to come up with ideas. So I put myself into character, and I haven't had a dog, and ironically, we just put our dog down 14 years. But I remember, what did I do when I trained my dog? And one of the things I trained the dog to do was to fetch a ball, bring it back, and play. It's not playing catch; it's playing fetch.
Fetch.
So that was the easiest one to think of because there's a throwing position is an action that's easily described in a visual illustration. And so he throws his arm. So, I get that action going, and then it's like I do it in three scenes to show this action where he throws the arm, the dog's running, and then what do you give a dog? I mean, you have to go through the whole thing. Why would a dog continue to do it? Because they get a reward out of it, and it's either usually a food treat or it's praise. So the next scene I have Bonaparte petting him on the head. And then the last little picture is he's confidently walking off with the dog following behind because he's trained him this new trick. And so a lot of times, I think as illustrators, we find ourselves in situations where we are called upon to bring our own personal life experience into a story. I'll give you another really quick one. It's in the same book where Bonaparte couldn't see. Where is everybody? He asked in a muffled voice. And so he's wrapped up as a mummy, and his friends wrapped up his eyes too, so he couldn't see. He looks like a mummy. Well, what's the worst thing that can happen if you can't see? If you're blindfolded, and I start going through those scenarios, like what would I draw? It doesn't say what I'm supposed to draw here.
Right.
Know?
Mm-hmm. This is the magic of illustration, is that we have to bring all this stuff to it.
It really is. It's really fun. And so I went through a lot of things. I was like bumping into a table. Not that dangerous, stepping on a skate, the classic, stepping on tacks or something, stepping on a Lego, but he's made of bone. So I'm like, well, that wouldn't really hurt. And then I came to falling downstairs. So I have him, the illustration, as I describe it, is his friend is holding him back by one of his strands of mummy bandages, and he's taking a step, and one more step, he would go downstairs in profile, and he's being held back. So you can see that the danger element, his friend's taking care of him, and it illustrates that point that he can't see.
Right.
So that's probably my first steps really are nailing that concept. And once I tickle myself when I come up with the concept, when I start laughing about it, I feel like it's probably a pretty good one. Then I show the client in a really loose sketch. And it's just an idea. It's a stick figure sketch. This is what I'm thinking. They love it.
Wait, so you do show the client in that rough thumbnail looking sketch.
So here's one thing that I really do with my clients is I work with the art director and I say, hey, I want to shoot you sketches before the deadlines for the sketches that are cryptic Pictionary type drawings that are for your eyes only. Please don't take them to your meetings because it'll freak everybody out.
Right.
They're going to be horrible. But I'm just to get the concept, and then you can get back to me if you think. You don't have to give me a definitive, yes, everyone's going to like this. You can just tell me if you like it.
Right.
You know
the beauty of that move, I think, this is another one that's hard learned. It's like, I think after a number of years, you feel comfortable submitting, I don't want to call them bad sketches, but extremely loose sketches, I wouldn't do in the beginning. What used to happen is I would submit them kind of like what you're saying. That was my intent, but I would overwork them. And then they would start commenting like, is that a Ford in the background or is that a Chevy truck? they get totally lost on some little detail that I'm not even, I just drew something in there, but I did it a little bit too far. And I think it's really important to know where that limit is. I mean, the looser it is and the more stick figure-y it is, there's no details for them to grab onto. They know that's not what the finished sketch is going to look right. like. And then they have to focus on what you're talking about. So that was a hard lesson for me to learn. And I kept getting that feedback. Like, no, I'm not even to that point yet. I don't want that kind of feedback yet. Right. Like, what kind of shirt they're wearing or something.
Right. I mean, I'm very clear with my art director. Look, these are going to be like, I'm talking stick figure just for action, just to show you what I'm thinking. Don't be freaked out by this. And you have to, you know, you have to develop a relationship.
Do you do that same level of stick figuring in your own personal images?
Oh, yeah.
How many thumbnails do you think you do?
Well, I can tell you right now, I'm doing some images for my own personal book that I'm getting ready to launch. I'm still doing a few last drawings for it. So that would be considered, you know, I am the client. Right. And I wanted was some images with a really fun idea where the image tells a story. It's just, there's no text. It just, you get the story from looking at the image. And so once I come up with the idea, just so I don't forget it, because sometimes I'm away from home and I've just got my iPad with me, I will just draw out a super cryptic idea visually so that I don't lose that image in my mind. Mm-hmm. And I just throw it on in a document in on my iPad in a drawing app. And it's, you know, you can barely, I think I draw it well enough that I think most people who are looking at it would know what's going on, but just not any farther, not past mm-hmm. that Pictionary mm-hmm. style, you know.
What about you, Jake? How's that thumbnail stage work for you?
Thumbnail stage, it goes like if it's for a client, I definitely send them something a little more polished, but obviously not rendered, right? So for me personally, I'll just go in and do illegible sketches to the outside eye. But I get in a bind because I'm so loose, I can't remember what I did the week before.
Well, that's right. Where the writing comes in. I do the same thing, but then I make little notes out to the side, like that's a, you know, whatever.
Right. But if it is for a client, it won't be a stick figure, but it will be like a blob figure. So they'll have a little bit of design to them, just a bit to give them an idea. And I was just, while Will was talking there, I was going back looking at this last children's book I did, comparing my initial sketches to my final renderings. And it's amazing to me how much I relied on those initial sketches, even mm-hmm. like a subtle turn of the head or the right. way the toes are kind of pigeon-toed just a little bit. Something that I was just rushing through, kind of trusting my gut. And then, And when I was sketching and then sticking to that trust, taking it to the final thing. But yeah, the next stage is just really fast, quick thumbnails, very loose. And I don't put all the effort and thought and creativity is going into the storytelling of the image and not the rendering of the image.
The drawing, right.
Yeah.
Right. How many do you do thumbnails?
It depends. So this Awesome Man 2 book that I was working on, which comes out later this year, I kind of did first pass because I could see the words were so well written. I could see the book in my head and I had some really creative ideas that I just sat down and, the way that I do it is I'll put the whole book on one page. And I used to do this traditionally. I used to have it on an actual piece of paper and I would draw the book out thumbnail form on one page so I could see how all the spreads kind of compare to each other. But now I do it in a Photoshop file digitally and I'm drawing all on one page and they're very small, but I can zoom in on them. Mm. And then those small images, I will blow up to the actual size and just do another pass over the top of them where I tighten it down a little bit better.
That's what
does pass mean when you say you do another pass?
Another pass is like doing draw it over. Once and then doing it again.
Because some people might not know what you're talking about when you say
yeah, that's good to clarify that. Pass. Mm-hmm. And so you do that digitally.
Should I define what a thumbnail is? Some people probably don't know what that is either. So it's,
wow,
a thumbnail. I think it comes from drawings that are the size of an actual thumbnail, but yeah. Mine are actually the size of maybe four thumbnails.
I want to talk together. About that because there's a lot of little things that I've, after seeing so many students go through my concept classes and illustration classes that, you know, just because something's called a thumbnail, I think everybody has a sweet spot for a size that they like drawing. And for me, that's the size is about 3.5-4 inches tall. If it gets smaller than that, it feels so compressed that I don't get good designs out of it.
Mm-hmm. And if it gets too big, then you're adding details so don't need to be there.
Right. And it's crazy how much more detail you can get in just by barely increasing the size, like a 3.5 inch maybe tall sketch to a 5.5 inch tall sketch. Man, it's a whole different ballgame. So I do want to throw out, you know, you guys find your own process for people listening. Like it might be a really little one or it might be a little bit bigger. Definitely want to avoid exactly what Jake said is going too big at that thumbnail phase. I'm surprised how many people don't go through a thumbnailing phase after watching so many students struggle. Because I noticed on we have a really robust forum area that a lot of people with at SVS that people submit drawings and they ask for feedback and help and stuff. And I just noticed early days, like now I think we've trained our students quite well. But when people would submit, they would submit a finished painting and say, hey, what does everybody think? And then people would start chiming in. Hey, that hand looks funny. It looks big. Or like the composition's a little bit weird and perspectives needs adjusting. Then they're trying to do that on a finished painting.
Yeah.
And you're looking at just hours go by because they've already rendered it and all the colors in place and they're trying all this stuff and it has to be finished. And I was just shocked at that. That's when I really started diving in and pushing the idea of understanding what that thumbnail phase is, that it's actually an ugly phase. This was a big thing for me too, is realizing that that stage is not a drawing stage. It's a thinking stage and it needs to be, for me, it just needs to no thought on how good the drawings are at that point. I just want to stress that because people like to have good thumbnails. They like to impress people with their drawing skills, but that's not the place for it. In my opinion. Do you guys agree?
I have a few things to say on thumbnails when Jake's done.
Well, I was just gonna add kind of back Lee up there that it's so much easier to fix something at that stage. There's like very low stakes.
Right.
When someone says, oh, this doesn't make sense, this isn't very clear, it's no big deal to like go and fix things than if you had spent, you know, 5 hours on rendering out that image. So definitely work that way. And even, you know, I'm at this point now too, where if I have spent a day rendering it, and someone's like, no, you need to start over. I'm like, oh, no big deal. It's just another day of working. I've done 100 of these before. I'll do another 100 again in my life. And this is just one of many. So I think that's when you know, once you get into that mindset, you've actually like crossed over from, I think, amateur to more professional.
Yeah, you realize it's just a constant work in progress and it can change at any moment. I mean, jobs can get scrapped and whole, like you have a single page layout and now it's a double page layout and everything has to change. I mean, that stuff happens all the time.
Yeah.
Go ahead. Well, what were you going to say?
When I was in school, I heard thumbnail, thumbnail, thumbnail. This is why you got to do it. I heard exactly what you guys said a million times. And yet I still wouldn't do them. And the reason was, one, because I have a thick skull. And two, I didn't really understand. Like, they would say things like you guys were saying where, you know, it helps you. It helps you to fix stuff early on so you don't waste time later. And I would say, in my mind, my response to that would be, well, I don't care if it takes me longer. I enjoy drawing. So I'm just going to work big and draw. And if it takes me more time. And what I would say to my 20-year-old self now is, hey, idiot, okay? What do you like the fact that you don't know if your illustration is going to come out the way you want it? Do you like that, not knowing? Or having bad, you know, flops that you just want to tear your hair out because the vision in your mind doesn't look anything like what you put on paper. Do you like that feeling? Do you like the feeling of you know, not having good enough pieces in your portfolio. Like you did this amazing one and you can't do anything better than that now. Do you like that feeling? Because if you don't do thumbnails, if you don't plan out in a small stage, that's what's going to happen. Because the thing that the thing that I would stress to the idiot 20-year-old of myself is when you start drawing bigger, you start adding value and time in. You start putting time because you've got more space to put time. So now you've banked your life into this drawing.
Right.
And now if you know, if you see something off that needs to be completely changed, you don't want to change it because that means throwing away banked time that you've put into it.
That's right.
Idiot, go back and do these little cryptic plans. And they won't be easy at first because you're saying to yourself, I can't draw. It's too small. I can't draw. That's the whole point of doing a thumbnail. You can't draw. You're designing. Designing is different than drawing.
That's a good distinction. I'm glad you said that. That's great.
Yep.
We had a project in my graduate program where we, it was brutal. We had to do 50 thumbnails. And this was just the first part of this exercise. So we had to do 50 thumbnails. And I can't remember what the topic was. I think, oh no, it was just an item. And we had to do 50. It was a teapot and a tea kettle. Or tea kettle, sorry, and a teacup. And you had to do 50 thumbnails of just these items in space. And so, you know, it was kind of interesting. Once we got, you know, 15 in, you get all rid of all the obvious thumbnails. And then you're left, you know, you got 35 more. And, you know, you get up around 40 and it gets really difficult. Well, I thought that was brutal. And then, but, you know, it was interesting once everybody put them on the wall and everybody still had, you know, even with just two items, everybody had completely different work, you know. And right. Then we had five scenes that we had to illustrate that week. It was a very compressed kind of time frame. We had five scenes we had to, that we were working on, and everybody's was individual to their own project. But we had to do 50 thumbnails for all five. So 250 thumbnails. And, at first it was brutal. I'm not going to lie. I mean, if you're not used to that, it really is brutal. But some of those where I would get around, you know, 10 or number 15 or whatever, and I'd be like, that is a nice one. And I would have gone with it. And then I get up around 30, 40, 45. And I get one that is so unexpected because you're just trying to move the camera around or move the concept or whatever you can do because you just need to, you just need to fill this number. And it made the one that I was going to go with look so bad. With how good some of these unexpected layouts got. And so that one really hit home with me. And how, now I don't do 50 every time now. I can get there with, you know, I think 5 to 10. Maybe if it's a real complicated scene, I'll do 15. But if you haven't done that, you guys should try it. You know, there's this YouTube guy I've been watching who has a video on doing 50 thumbnails. His name's Lee Wyatt. You guys should go check that out. I did document that process.
While you're on YouTube, type in draw 100 somethings project. And that was my whole gist with that was the same thing. It's just pushing through your creative barriers to find something completely unexpected. Another way to do that too is this works, especially if you're doing like an illustrated image story, but if you're doing a design of like a character or a prop or something like that, is to just get a Sharpie and just do little thumbnails. Fill a 8.5 by 11 sheet of paper of these little silhouette thumbnails with just a Sharpie. Sharpie you can't do details with, and so you absolutely all you have to rely on is shape. And how do you find interesting contrast in the shapes that you're doing, and you're gonna find something that works with a blunt Sharpie on the shape level. That once you start adding details into it, and you expand it out, and you design it out better, it's gonna just fundamentally be a better design than something where if you were just going straight at it without thinking about those elements to it.
That's really good. I want to add one of my thumbnailing pet peeves. If I can throw that out there, because this is what happens whenever I give, as a teacher, give an assignment, say do 30 thumbnails or do 50 thumbnails, whatever. Students immediately, and I understand this tendency, they want to speed up just the process of setting it up. And so they go down and they make basically like almost like a checkerboard pattern on a on a piece of paper saying each of those squares is going to be its own thumbnail. Well, what happens is each thumbnail is butted up against the one right next to it because you basically made a grid, and now each thumbnail affects the one next to it. And so you don't get a true sense of design because it's all jammed together like that. So give your thumbnails some breathing room. Don't just make a grid thinking you're saving time by, you know, just making that quick shape.
Right.
Cautionary tales of thumbnailing.
can I give you another little thing on thumbnailing?
Yeah.
That I've
been all day here.
I've never heard anybody say this, and I want to, you know, and I've taught this in some of our classes. So I'm just going to ask you guys if you think there's anything to it, because I haven't really asked. I've just taught it, and I think Jake's heard it before. But, you know, in my when I was teaching at UVU, I was really interested in why I couldn't look at a thumbnail that I had drawn that I really liked. You know, the design looked really good, and I couldn't transpose it bigger into like a 4x5. So let's say it's a 1 inch by 1 inch.
Yeah.
And, or, you know, 1.5 by 1. And I couldn't scale it up and get the spatial relationships.
It just loses that energy.
It loses all the energy. It loses the negative space. Mm-hmm. I would draw the main objects. If I superimposed them later on, I still would like that little thumbnail better than the bigger one.
Yeah.
So I started thinking about it, and I realized I just had a thought that maybe it's because I can focus completely on the little thumbnail and I can't focus on 4x5. So I got a book out and I looked at text, and those that are listening, if you have a book or even on your phone, get a text document and hold it the distance that you would draw, you know, which is about 12 to maybe 18 inches away. And when you're holding a text document, you can only focus on about two words if you're reading at a time, which gives you about a 1 inch by 1 inch zone. You think in your mind that you can see a whole 8.5 by 11 piece of paper. You can't. Your eyes dart around so fast that everything seems like it's in focus.
Right.
But you can't focus on the whole thing. If you focus on two words that are in focus, don't move your eyes and be aware of what the rest of the page looks like. It's all blurry. So my theory is that we can tap into our design sense better at that smaller size. The smaller, the better to design.
That's always been, I think that's a great thing to bring up. It's actually really interesting. I've always hated the trying to go from small to big. Mm-hmm. And as much as I've gotten rid of that, I mean, we're going to go into how we make final art and all that stuff too. And that becomes part of that discussion. But I've basically eliminated the redrawing of something. I basically think of it almost like Jake does with a pass, in that if I'm going to do something, I'm going to use that thumbnail. I'm not going to try to redraw something from scratch ever. Either I blow it up, like I take that crappy thumbnail, I blow it up really big, and it looks terrible when I blow it up to like 16 by 20 or bigger, and I print it off of my printer, and that's what I actually draw on top of. I don't try to redraw something from scratch because it sucks. It always tightens up and it just looks funny. Even a slight change of the proportion will make it look.
It's so good to hear that, because I thought there was something wrong with me for the longest time because I had to do that. But then I started finding other people that do that too.
Yeah, I do the same thing. You're not alone. Well,
it's weird how hard that is though, and how consistent. I mean, how the little sketch can have so much energy and. Sometimes it never comes through. Like, so I do an image, I know the thumbnail works great, and the regular painting never equaled what the thumbnail was. It took years, I think, for me to be able to have the quality of the sketch in the finish. And I think that's important to say, because I think a lot of students struggle with that last step of tightening up.
I agree.
Yeah.
All right, now I have the next, you know, between thumbnail and I have them separated here, and I just want to, we don't have to talk long about it, but I have a thumbnail phase, which is that gross phase, and it's loose. And then a rough sketch phase with value. And then I go to tight sketch. And I've got those as 3, 4, and 5 for me. Are those integrated for you guys, that step, or are they distinct steps? Where do you go from that really loose?
Because I work digitally, I often have lost all the little sketching and finding and searching because I'm constantly working on top of the same thing. I started archiving for teaching purposes and just to be able to see the progression. But I go through sometimes, you know, 5 to 10 different iterations after the thumbnail, you know, but I'll sometimes have 10 drawings, and it's fun to put them in a, like a slideshow and just superimpose them and watch them kind of, you know, get tighter and tighter and tighter until the final sketch.
Yeah. And you're doing that, like, to get specific, you're doing it. So you're in Procreate or whatever you're making, and you've got mm-hmm. your loose rough sketch on the bottom. And then do you make another layer and then basically lighten that, the loose sketch layer, and then draw on top of it? Or what does that look like?
I kind of have developed two styles now. So I have the drawing crosshatch style, which is the drawing, which I love, because as I work up to final drawing, the final drawing is the final. And then I just color that. So that's one style. When I paint with digital paint over top of my drawing, the drawing is always there underneath. It's always preserved on the bottom layer. And usually when I start painting, I'm in Photoshop anyway, I've learned one of the hardest things for students to figure out how to do, both in traditional paint and digital paint, is how to maintain their drawing so that the painting doesn't, so that the drawing doesn't change as they start painting. So they end up with, you know, sometimes they'll have a beautiful drawing and as they're painting it, they completely lose the drawing and start making it up because they can't see what's going on underneath. So the real hard part of learning how to paint is learning how to maintain your drawing. Digitally, it's easier because you can have it underneath. You can always refer back to it. Painting traditionally is much more difficult.
When do you guys add value to your planning sketch, to your rough sketch? Does it start with value when you did your thumbnails, or do you add that later?
Unless light and shadow and value, those things, unless they're playing like a storytelling role, they're not a part of it until after I've done the drawing. So like, for example, you know, if it's a kid walking to school in the middle of the day, I'm not going to worry about light and shadow and value too much.
This is interesting, because I would have guessed that from you, because you seem like you're a natural drawer.
Because your value sucks so bad. That's
you have no value, Jake.
Appreciate that.
I would have guessed that.
But if the story was like a kid walking through the woods at night and his flashlight is on and he's trying to, like, you know, see around the tree, absolutely, then those, you know, the lighting is playing a huge element.
So it's sort of like as needed, you add the value. See, I think some people are natural drawers and some people are natural painters. And for me, I'm thinking in terms of value before I even think of drawing, almost.
Mm-hmm. Me too.
And so it's right there from the very beginning.
That's why we don't draw as good as Jake.
That's pretty true.
We think of, but I do, in the thumbnail, I'm going value, right? From the thumbnail, like, I want to know where my focal point is, and I usually control that with a value contrast. The highest value contrast is usually the focal point, unless you add an accent color in there too. So I'm thinking about, I'm seeing it as it's a like little thumbnails from a storyboarded movie, you know?
Yeah, that's what I do too. I mean, I also have found that I can have a very loose drawing, but if I go in there with like four to five values at most, sometimes it's just a three value setup, but it's almost always just one of those limited value kind of things. I can pitch, it just tightens up the sketch so much, and it'll show you, what it does for me is it shows me where I need to actually draw and what can remain sort of hazy as in terms of value. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like, otherwise you just draw everything that's in a shot. And I think again, that starts to lead to overdrawing unless you have a good discipline with drawing and you can say, okay, that's the background. I'm not going to add every brick to that building back there. But I see students that do that, you know, in their smaller sketches, they'll add every single thing because there's nothing back there. But if it's a building that's in silhouette, it's just a big blob. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I have to admit that it took me a little while to figure that out, where here I'm drawing a tree and, instead of drawing every leaf, I could just put a slap of value there.
Right.
That kind of, it's the eye blur representing the leaves there. Mm-hmm. I also have really good 2020 vision, so or 2020 plus vision. So I see details all the time. I could look at a tree across the field and see individual leaves on it. And whereas I remember talking to my uncle one time, and he had borrowed my mom's glasses, and he put them on. And he goes, "Oh, there's leaves on those trees." And so for him, it was just like cotton balls, right? You know, like big green, green cotton balls. And I was like, "Yeah, there's leaves on the trees."
That's pretty good. That's really good. Yeah. So I think it just depends on whether you're a drawer or a painter, whether you think in value or whether you think in line. Mm-hmm. But I don't know. That's always an interesting thing. Oh, I got one note here that I wanted to add to my thumbnailing that enabled me to speed up and get a lot more thumbnails. I just wanted to add that so I don't forget. And that is, when I first draw a thumbnail, it's basically we've used the term storyboard here a couple of times in this episode, but for me, it really is a storyboard. Like if there's, all these people receiving this letter, like the mm-hmm. image I'm doing right now, the first pass is literally like just people standing around holding a letter. There's no intent that that's going to be a real one, a real image, but I just get just the facts. Like, here's the place and here's all the players that are involved in this shot. And if there's a car there, the car will be there. But the storyboard is not an actual thumbnail that I'm trying to use for the book. It's never intended to be a design. It's just a starting point. And then from that point, I sort of start to adjust the camera and move the characters around in subsequent thumbnails. Do you guys sort of do that too? Like kind of here's all the stuff that's going to be in this shot, and then you start designing? Or do you, from your first thumbnail, do you try to say, okay, here's maybe a shot that this is going to be?
Can I take this, Will?
Again,
it depends on what the usage of that image is for. So if it's a environment that I'm going to return to several times in a story, then I will concept it out and kind of do an orthographic view of it, or a three-quarter top-down view of it. So I know, okay, we've got table over here, we've got refrigerator over here, we've got bookshelf over here. But if I'm only going to be there once and never return to it, then I just design for the camera angle that I want. And the
don't need camera to angle explore that, all that other stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the camera angle I'm picking is based on the needs of the storytelling moment. Mm-hmm. So if it's, right, you know, the POV of the child, then it's going to be a lower angle. If it's the POV of the adult, it's going to be an upper, you know, down, looking down angle, those types of things.
It sounds like you're doing a lot of editing in your mind before mm-hmm. you waste time exploring every single one, because you've done all these, you've seen all these problems before. You've solved them, and you know that there's some angles that are inappropriate for what you're trying to tell.
Yeah. And I remember when I was first teaching myself to draw comics, I was like, how am I ever going to figure out what image goes in what panel and what camera angle? And I was getting so frustrated. And what I ended up doing was I would close my eyes and envision it as a film. So I'm watching a movie and I've grown up watching movies. Your brain, I think, kind of understands editing, movie editing a little bit, like camera angles and things like that. And so I would think, well, for this particular action, I wouldn't want to be close up because I couldn't see what his hands are doing, and it's important to see what his hands are doing. So I'm envisioning a mid shot. And once I have the storyboard in my head, then it's just thinking, okay, how can I fit those storyboards on on a page mm-hmm. in an interesting way? You know,
that's good. Okay, so you've gone through your thumbnail sketches. You've picked the one that's going to be the hero shot, and you're excited about painting it. Do you go to color studies next? Or I mean, for me, color studies, especially if it's a book. If it's a book cover, no. Actually, I was going to revise that. I do color studies on almost everything now. If I'm going to go to finish, I do a number of color studies, and they're fast and quick, but I love having that guide. If you ever want to do a really fast finished painting, have a good color study. It's amazing how quick it speeds it up. Do you guys do color studies? And if so, what's that look like?
Nope.
Boom. Well, hashtag lazy.
You know what? Let me say that again. There are some paintings that I definitely do color studies on, and they, But one thing that I will do sometimes is I will use someone else's art.
Ooh, and use someone else's
use someone else's art and look, use their color scheme. I'll just pick colors from it, and then, you know, it's a totally different piece of art that I'm doing. Yeah. Not even related, but
I'm glad you said that, because it's important for people to know. I mean, in this digital world with theft and all that stuff, color is not copyrightable. Steal and steal and steal away.
Yeah.
So I've done that too, my fair share.
Yeah. So sometimes I'll do that. Sometimes I will explore and take my final drawing and then just do a really loose pass color over that drawing several times, maybe three or four times, just to see if I'm unsure. But most of the time I can visualize it. I can see what I want to do and kind of get there that way.
I feel that way if it's a single image, but if I'm doing like the picture book that I just finished a couple weeks ago, I love having the full thing up, because sometimes an individual image will look great, but depending on what's before it or after it, it may not make any sense to be that color or that value. Maybe it's a time of day even kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. So this color's always been a hard thing for me to do. And this is where I always get in over my head, and maybe I should do more color studies, but essentially what I do is I've done the thing where I like this color scheme that this person's done, so I'm going to try and copy that. And usually I find out that it doesn't work for what I'm wanting to do. So I have to go in there and like fix things. And it's took me a long time to figure out like how to color and how to make color work. And I've done a bunch of iffy, you know, bad color stuff just because I do that thing where maybe I imagine things in black and white. Like I could see very clearly linearly and in value, but I may not see very clearly in color because I'm always finding out what the color is going to be on the page. I can't see that in my head very well.
Well, I notice you tend to gravitate towards analogous color schemes quite a bit. I do too, and which I think is just a surefire way of controlling your color. Mm-hmm. So if you
explain
back
what
out,
analogous or if you, is because I don't know what you're talking about.
Analogous is colors that are very close to each other on mm-hmm. the color wheel. So it'll mm-hmm. be an all over warm color. You know, there'll still be some cool colors worked in there, but it's mainly. My idea of that is like if you kind of held the painting at a distance and squinted a little bit, blurred a little bit, it would be, this is an all over red painting, or this is sort of a blue-green right, yeah. painting. It has a theme. It has a color theme instead of each individual item in a painting being its own color, like green grass, you know, there's a red barn and a blue sky and this other thing. You know, I mean, you start yeah. coloring like that and the color can get away from you so fast.
Right.
So I noticed early on that I'm just really attracted to these limited palette images. The ability to control the color and value is a lot easier when it's close together like that. So I tend to use it quite a bit. Now, Will, on the other hand, seems to go for a complementary color scheme quite a bit, I've noticed, because he uses lighting, I think, more than Jake and I do. Mm-hmm. So he'll have an orange and blue kind of painting, with the orange being the light portion and then the blue being, you know, heavily saturated shadow kind of areas. So is that by choice, Will, or are you just kind of finding it as you go?
I've done some analogous color schemes as well. It seems more natural to me. Like as I start painting, I kind of end up there with the compliments, you know. Mm-hmm. So
you control them pretty well compared to I mean for me, when I try to do that, it gets away from me and it looks too loud. How do you feel like you can control that?
A lot of them look too loud.
Has your color sensibility changed since you were?
It has. I'd like to think that it's slightly more sophisticated now. Where I can really, probably the biggest thing I'm trying to control now is saturation, and so that my focal points really stand out. Mm-hmm. So like with the Draw 50 things, I put red, you know, intense red, you know, saturated red in one spot where I want to lead your eye. And then it also happens to be high contrast there in value. So, you know, I'd like to think that I'm technically a little bit stronger and more deliberate in my approach now than I was, you know, 10 or 20 years ago. Cause back then I was just anything goes, you know. I like these saturated colors, so I'm going to use them, you know. Mm-hmm. And I realized over time that that color looks even more saturated when you control it in other areas and neutralize it, and crescendo to a saturation in a few places rather than.
Give me an example of that. So what you're saying is, like, if I want something to appear really vibrant, really red, say for example, I mm-hmm. might use a muted kind of palette everywhere else, and that way the red looks hotter versus if I used a really hot color everywhere.
Yeah. So if often you can coincide with light. So you can say you've got this repeating color on different objects. That's, let's call it, say red. That's happening in your painting, and it's repeating, but it's repeating everywhere in shadow. So that red is going to be more neutralized with dark. I mean, digitally, you'd add black. With actual paint, you could add like a dioxazine purple to darken it. You could add ultramarine blue or something to darken your red. But no matter how you're doing it, you're gonna take the value of that red and you're gonna darken it or lighten it up. If it's in the distance, if it's blown out in light, you know, in sunlight, it might not appear as saturated either. And then where you really want your viewer to look, that's where you go straight from the tube or, you know, with a primary color digitally you're hitting that full saturation on your color picker. And if you control it, it's just, I had David Small, the Caldecott winning illustrator, really gave me a harsh critique one time. I've told the story a bunch of times, so I'm not going to tell the whole story, but he was very critical of my color, and I was offended for a day and a half, you know.
What did he say? I'm curious. I can't remember that story.
We were at dinner, and one of my students asked for a critique. Actually, wasn't one of my students. It was, he was a student, but he wasn't one of mine. And, anyway, asked for a critique, and I thought, well, I want to get a critique too from a Caldecott winning illustrator. And he just told me, he's like, are you sure you want a critique from me? Because I don't pull any punches.
Ooh.
And I'm like,
warning.
I couldn't back down at that point because there were a bunch of students at the table, you know. I'm like, sure, I can take it. So he says, send me one of your images to critique or a book or something, and I'll let you know. So luckily, I didn't get it in front of everybody. But he emailed me the next week with a letter, and he just said, why do you use so much damn color everywhere? You know, like he says, what you're doing, the equivalent of what you're doing, and I needed this analogy, is a movie that is nonstop action where there is no dialogue, much like, almost like Fury Road. Fury Road, I love that movie, but there are soft, quiet moments.
It's a Will Terry movie.
It is. It really is. But there are soft, quiet moments. A few and far between. I think the first action sequence goes for like 25 minutes. But in order to have impact with those scenes, with the action, you've got to break it up. And the way you do it with your breaking up color is to neutralize your colors and then save the saturation for the really important parts of your painting.
That's good stuff. That's really good stuff. Jake,
can I tell you how...
Go ahead.
Can I tell you how I color?
Sure.
So what I do is I have the swatches from Photoshop, like the default swatches, and I just start coloring everything with those swatches straight, like, I guess from the tube is what you'd call it. Color everything that what I want it to be, and then I go into hue saturation and I desaturate it like 25%. So now it's those colors, but a little bit grayer, a little bit duller. And then I go into color, what is it called? It's image color balance is what it is.
Okay.
And there you can turn everything a little bit redder or a little bit yellower, or a little bit bluer, or a little bit purpler. And what I'll do is I'll just start sliding these things until I find something that looks a little more homogeneous, and that's where I think these colors start going into that what you called it earlier, what was
analogous
it? Analogous, right? So that that's where things start to get analogous. And then I'll look at it all and I'll find something where I do just want a pop of something opposite. So if you have the color wheel, most of my colors are going to be on one side of the color wheel, and then I'll have one color be on the opposite side of it. And that's sort of trying to balance out everything.
But not in equal proportion. The opposite side is just a little spot.
It'll be a little spot. It'll be one element. So yep. if everything's browns and blues, then someone will have like a red shirt. You know, mm-hmm. the character I want you to focus on will have like a red shirt, something like that.
I do that too. That same thing. I have all over cool, a little bit of warm, or all over warm, a little bit of cool. You guys should Google, for the listeners, if you're in front of a computer, Google movie posters. And that little breakdown, all over cool, a little bit of warm, or all over warm, a little bit of cool, is like 90% of movie posters.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's funny how often they use that blue-orange kind of palette, and then they split the percentages like that. Color's tricky. I'm not going to lie. Color's the hardest part for me. It used to be just the line work, but now that I've learned how to draw, I think. Color's always hard. It's never going to be an easy one. And that step when I'm doing especially a children's book that's, you know, multiple pages, I always just get a little freaked out. It's a lot of mental energy to do the color. Mm-hmm. And so I just want to throw that out there because I think almost everybody struggles with the color. I mean, all three of us have said that it's hard. Even stealing color, like Jake said, like you're like, oh, that color looks great, but then it doesn't work when you try it on your image. That happens a lot.
Right.
All right. So the next part is the last little bit of it. So we've gone through our thumbnails, we've gone through our research and development, we've gone through our client brief or our own brief, got it all the way to a tight sketch, done the color study, and now it's time for final art. I kind of wanted each of you guys, and tell me if you think this would be too long or you can't do it. Due to whatever reason, but walk us through making a piece of final art. Like, okay, so you got your sketch and then I'd like to just hear the process, like what brush are you using in Photoshop? How are you setting your layers up? We don't have to go crazy. You know, I don't want to spend an hour talking mm-hmm. a verbal description of Photoshop, but is there a process you can describe kind of?
I'll go first because mine's pretty simple.
Go ahead.
Not that yours isn't, Jake, but I believe in simple processes in digital. If you're trying to achieve a more traditional feel, you should paint more traditionally digitally. In other words, you should limit the tools that you use and keep your process as simple as possible, so that you can because you know when you're painting traditionally, you're going to have part of what makes a painting or a drawing that's done traditionally look traditional are the imperfections, the mm-hmm. fact that everything isn't perfect. And so one thing that I do is I really limit my layers. In fact, I'll have a sketch layer and then I'll have a tone layer where I add, I often paint from a warm tone over my whole drawing, kind of like an underpainting that an old master's painter would do. Kind of like a grisaille, and I put value in that next. So I have a value layer is my third layer, and then my fourth layer is I lay in colors on a multiplied layer, and then my fifth layer is just painting directly on top.
Explain the multiplied layer for people who don't know.
So a multiplied layer is in Photoshop allows you to, when you set the layer to multiply, it mimics somewhat what would happen if you were using a marker. So when you put paint down, it lays down very, very transparent. It's not opaque, and I think they call it multiply because it adds in, or I don't think
it adds value. It adds value to what's underneath it. The way that I describe it in class is like almost like stained glass is what it looks like on top. If you had you know, whatever color you're painting with a stained glass and you just hold it over your drawing, that's what it would look like.
And the reason that I do that is because I'm trying to add color, but I want to see my drawing really well, and it doesn't cover up the drawing at all. So I'm adding.
So you're sort of tinting everything that's underneath.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Tinting and shading, and then the final paint layer is opaque paint that goes on top of everything else. And then I work I will keep flattening. I'll get another layer. When I get some paint that I like, I'm like, okay, I like the paint that I put down. I get a new layer and then I paint on that. And then when I look at and I evaluate, I'll turn that layer on and off and I'll check it to see if I've overcooked the painting, if I've put too much paint on. If so, I'll reduce the layer opacity, but I'll always flatten to that fifth layer. As I like paint, I flatten to that. I get a new layer, paint on that. If I like it, flatten to that. And I just keep flattening so I don't end up with, you know, 100 layers because I don't need all those. I don't need to go back. I'm committing just like you would if you were doing an oil painting or an acrylic painting. I'm saying what I've done so far is good and I'm keeping it. And then at the end, I'll do a kind of a color adjustment layer. But that's basically my process.
That's good. That's cool. I like keeping it simple like that. I mean, it does make it a lot easier than having a billion different layers. Mm-hmm. Jake, what about you? Oh, wait, one question to Will before we leave. What brushes are you painting with for your opaque layer that goes?
I mean, I use the airbrush and I modify it so I've made a texture brush with the airbrush. And then I just change the hardness and softness with the bracket keys on the keyboard. Mm-hmm. And I will toggle on and off shape dynamics to get if I want a point or if I want to have it softer, and I'll toggle off my texture. I keep it really simple. That's all I'm using.
You ever paint traditionally anymore?
That's the goal. So the short answer is no. The long answer is I love pushing paint around. I just at this time in my career, I just don't see.
It takes so much time.
Yeah. Yeah. So right now it's not fitting in with the projects that I'm doing. But my goal, I mean, I would love to be able, because I hike a lot, I want to be able to hike out and do plein air paintings. That's like a cool. Kind of a.
We should do that next time we hang out.
That's my on Golden Pond kind of the way I see myself.
That should be the last portion of our battle, is a plein air painting battle.
Oh, yeah. Three of us. Well, I've got that, so I guess I'm going to win the whole thing.
You will get crushed on that one. Jake, what's your process?
So this is for the majority of any professional work that I do. A lot of my stuff is very line-based, so the final is going to have some sort of inking element to it or pencil element to it, but it always starts digitally. All right, I'll sketch, thumbnail sketch, and do initial sketches digitally. And what I'm doing is I'm just building those sketches up layer by layer. Once that thumbnail's done, I'll blow it up to the size it needs to be. I'll lighten it, you know, put the opacity down 20% to 20%. And then I'll do a more polished line work over that. I'll drop the opacity down on the polished line work and do another pass at it again if it needs it. And once I have a good solid line work, I'll actually print it out on my paper, on my printer, on just paper that I use to ink on. And I'll ink over the top of it, or I'll pencil over the top of it. And then I'll scan that in, and then I'll color it. And usually what I'll do is I'll have my line work be the multiply layer. And then I will do the coloring underneath it. And when you multiply with white, it's like same with the stained glass thing. If you put a piece of transparent clear glass over a drawing, all you will see is the drawing underneath. But if that glass has Sharpie on it, you'll see the color underneath, except for where the Sharpie is. And that's how the multiply layer works with line work. And so then I'll do a layer of flat colors, and then I'll do a shadow layer, which is a multiply layer, but with a purple. Probably I usually use purple for my shadows. And then I'll do an overlay layer for my lighting. And then I'll do a couple of adjustment layers to kind of mess with colors and fix things. And then extra layers as needed for little fixes or little highlights and little pops of white, or, you know, pops of really dark or something like that. Mm-hmm. Then I call it good.
Very smooth. It's funny how close your process matches mine and how different our art looks.
Yeah.
I mean, our layer process is almost exactly the same. It's funny. So I'll reiterate what Jake said with a little bit of modification. So I start with a thumbnail and put that on its own layer, set it to multiply, and I drag the opacity back to about 10%. So I'm seeing, and that sketch layer stays on top of everything the entire time, but it's just barely there. And I start from the background and work all the way to the foreground, just filling in each of my layers for local value. So there's no lighting, there's no shadows, there's no lighting elements on there. It's literally just local value and local color. And I build each layer up, each shape up by itself with a couple of different ink texture brushes that I've built. Mm-hmm. And that's typically a two-step process from a background color and then a broken texture on top so that first layer shows through. And I do that with every shape in the image. So my process now almost doesn't feel like painting, which is the only bummer about it. And that's why I kind of like doing the traditional paintings now, is I'm almost designing. I'm using the lasso tool a lot to make these shapes, or I'm using layer masks to make the shapes. But everything's just flat. And when I get done with that and everything's in place, that part has to look good. I don't want shadow or lighting to save my image. It should look pretty good at that point, like 80%. I should be happy with it if I just turned it in with no shading and no lighting. And so I tweak those elements quite a bit, look at them very carefully. Once I like that, then I go on to shadow, just like Jake, multiply layer with typically a little bit of a violet hue and add shadow. But I just want to make this really clear, because you've got, as an illustrator, you've got a choice on what you light and what you don't. And so I only add shadows. I use shadow as a design element. If there's lighting coming through my image, it may hit something and not hit anything else, or vice versa. I just use it where I need to, and I don't use it. Mm-hmm. An example of that, by the way, would be like if I had an overall night scene, and my characters may not have any of that night scene on them. They're painted like they're in the day. Hmm. And I do that a bunch. The light, the night doesn't envelop them like it would in a realist kind of image. Anyway, I use, similar to Jake, I have instead of overlay for the lights, I use Vivid Light. You guys ever use that?
I like dull light.
There ain't no dull light. So Vivid Light, if I'm lighting something like a lantern or something like that, I love a really saturated color. And if you set it to Vivid Light, it actually changes as it gradiates out from... And you just got to experiment with it, because it's impossible to talk about what that does. But it's just different than spray painting opaque paint on top of like a lantern glowing or something like that. It really makes it look like it's glowing and hot. And I typically overdo it and have to reduce the saturation. But anyway, so I get that down. So now I've got the local colors all down, the shadow elements down, the lighting elements down. At that point, it's just a play day. And I typically schedule a full day from that point just to mess around and destroy the image after that, because typically it looks too clean for me. And so I'll start adding collage elements, and then my last layer is just line work and mess. I just throw all kinds of ink on it and mess it up, and that's it. Oh, the one last layer I will say is that if I'm submitting for a publisher, I typically have a adjustment layer on top that's just curves or levels, and I just basically brighten the overall image, because things typically get darker when you send them to print, and I hate getting back a book or something and it's too dark. Mm-hmm. You guys add that little layer, or do you just like trust your monitor?
I typically have trusted my monitor and haven't had too many problems, but I think my monitor, I run it a little bright too, or a little dark maybe.
Oh, that's smart.
However I do it, it works.
Okay. Just something so you guys know, there's a thing called dot gain for our listeners, and things just gain, especially if you're doing black and whites for like an interior on newsprint. It'll typically get a little darker because the paper absorbs the inks. I just worry about things going a little dark. I've seen more images come out of press being dark from not just myself but other illustrators. So I'd rather my image be a little bit too light, maybe I'm probably the only one that would notice, versus it being too dark and everybody saying, oh, I can't see it because it's too dark.
Yeah.
You should see my copy of Polar Express. It is so dark. It's the worst printing I've ever seen. I saw another Polar Express at the bookstore, and I was like, oh my gosh, that must have been a different run because it looked fantastic. Mine's super dark.
Yeah, and the thing with printing too is it could just have been a heavy ink day on the printer.
Yeah,
you know, for some of those. So
who knows? Maybe switch printers mid run, because you know Polar Express has probably gone into print multiple times. So you know, right. Maybe use a different printer, different paper, whatever. Anyway, that's going to wrap us up, man. I guess you can take us out if you want to.
Sounds good, unless Will has anything he wants to add.
I concur.
Concurred.
All right. Thanks for joining us, everybody. Three-Point Perspective is made possible by svslearn.com, where becoming a great illustrator starts. And your hosts here today have been Will Terry, Lee White, and Jake Parker. Now, you can see Will Terry's work, the work we've been talking about, at willterry.com, or you can follow him on Instagram at willterryart. Lee White, you can find his work at leewhiteillustration.com, or you can follow him on Instagram at leewhiteillo. And my website is mrjakeparker.com, or you can follow me on Instagram at Jake Parker. Podcast produced by Aaron Painter. You can find his work at painterdraws.com. Podcast edited. Been talking for an hour and
he's gonna edit that
getting
out.
Mushy. podcast edited by Alex Sugg, and you can find his work at alexsugg.com. That's Sugg with two G's. And podcast video for our YouTube watchers is edited by Daniel Tu, and you can find his stuff at daniel2.co, and that's two spelled T-U. Podcast is shared online by Lisa Fott. She is our SVS Learn social media specialist, so special thanks to her and all her work that she does there. Now, if you like this episode, we'd love it if you share it around. Pass it on to your friends who are also on this journey of art with you. If you haven't yet subscribed to it on iTunes or wherever it is that you do listen to podcasts, the little podcasting app on your phone is great. And while you're there, leave a review. We'd love to hear what you think. Now, if you're wanting to join in on this particular discussion, you can log on to the svslearn.com forums. Those forums are free to join. We've got a great community going on over there. People are sharing artwork and getting feedback from one another. It's a really nice, safe place to kind of grow as an artist. And there's always a discussion happening around each one of these podcast episodes. So chime in over there and let us know your thoughts about what you think about what we talked today. And that is it. We will see you next episode. Bye.